November 2nd, 1917. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievements of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. With those few words, Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, expressed the government's support for the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, which was then an Ottoman region with a small minority Jewish population. That declaration led to the development of Israel, and how did U.S. and Israel relations develop from there? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me to follow the ongoing changing relationship between Israel and the United States is Daniel Hummel, the director of the Lumen Center in Madison and a research fellow in the history department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, if we look at the history of the Middle East, that part of the Middle East, Palestine, Israel, we would be at it for a very long time, a couple thousand years at least. So let's start at the key year of 1948. And, of course, the U.S. is a well-established country with a lot of international relationships at this point. But how does the U.S. and Israel relationship begin?
Well, 1948 is a really important year. That's the year that Israel is established as a state. And I think one of the first things to just recognize, and this is often when we talk about U.S.-Israel relations, we tend to talk about it almost in isolation, like these are, you know, two countries that are relating to each other. But of course, both of them are relating to all other types of countries as well. And so in 1948, for the U.S. in particular, it's the dawn of the Cold War. And any type of Middle East foreign policy that the U.S. is considering is inevitably going to be filtered through the emerging struggle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And so even when the declaration of Israel's statehood is proclaimed by David Ben-Gurion, it's a race to who can acknowledge acknowledge Israel's statehood faster. And so U.S. does it in record time in 11 minutes. President Harry Truman makes sure to get it on the record that the U.S. supports the state of Israel. And it's even interesting to think about the domestic politics of that time. So today we often think that Israel is, well, it's largely a bipartisan issue. We have a Democratic president who's supporting Israel, and we have Republicans who support Israel. But back then, it was largely a liberal issue. It was a democratic issue. Israel was seen as a socialist state, a state that had a strong central government, a planned economy, a state that was a humanitarian project after the Holocaust. And so Truman has foreign policy reasons why he's wanting to acknowledge Israel early and try to get Israel on the side of, as he would call it, the free world, of the anti-communist coalition emerging in the Cold War. But he also had political reasons why he was interested as well in sort of a democratic political world. And finally, a third reason why Truman, if we're just going to focus on Truman as a key actor here, is Truman was a Christian. He was born into a Christian home. He read the Bible all the time. And so he did have a cultural, religious sympathy for the Jewish people because of that background. And even after, because of his early recognition of Israel, even after he was out of office, he would often refer to himself as Cyrus, the biblical king who allowed some Jews to return to the Promised Land after exile in Babylon. So Truman had a biblical sense about what was happening in the Middle East as well that colored how he viewed the region and colored how he understood what was happening with the creation of a state of Israel.
If you mention the politics, though, the politics in this country in 1948, Truman is up for election, having filled in for FDR after FDR died in 1945. Truman is hoping to be elected in his own right in 1948. What kind of Jewish voting bloc, if any, existed in this country? Certainly, Jewish contingent was powerful in the media. Mm. But beyond that, what kind of voting bloc did we see?
There was a significant one, and maybe more than even the reality was the perception within the Truman campaign that Jewish votes were really important in key states like New York. Jews, by this point, were dependable Democratic voters coming out of the New Deal. And so this was on the mind of Truman as he was in a very close race with Dewey. And maybe this is a sign that this is another way a lot of Americans think about U.S.-Israel relations is as an element of American domestic politics, that there's always an electoral and a political dimension to the foreign policy. There's a famous line from a senator right around the same time, Arthur Vandenberg, who said politics ends at the water's edge. This was a phrase that he used and that was invoked over and over again afterward, which was this quite idealistic understanding of American foreign policy, that that's beyond politics, that we should find consensus on foreign policy and really just focus when we're doing our political bickering on domestic politics. Well, I think the U.S.-Israel relationship is maybe exhibit number one of where that is not a true statement, and that every president since Truman has had to think about the domestic political implications, whether they're in an election year or not, of where they land on supporting Israel, on a peace process, and on many other related issues to the Middle East. And I think Truman, you know, sort of charted those waters as the first president to have to deal with this. And after the election, he of course wins the election in 1948. This was a major debating point: was did Truman recognize Israel for domestic political reasons? And this was seen by some, at least, as out of bounds, while others understood what he was doing there. And if they supported him, they were okay with it as well.
In that election of 1948, what was the Republican attitude toward Israel? I mean, they clearly want to court the Israeli-American vote.
Yes. It's hard maybe to go back, but the Republican Party back in the 1940s and 50s was not seen as a pro-Israel party. They were much more interested in making sure that oil was easy to access. And so this meant making sure not to anger Arab states in the region, and Arab states did not like the recognition of Israel. So this was the position of Thomas Dewey, the Republican opponent in 1948, and this was particularly the position of the Eisenhower administration, which comes in after Truman. Among diplomatic historians, the 1950s is considered the most, and I'm putting this in quotes, even-handed period of U.S.-Israel relations, where the Eisenhower administration, because of these broader economic, natural resource, Cold War frameworks, was trying to be even-handed in its policy to Israel and the Arab states. And this was seen by particularly Democrats at the time as far too cold to Israel because of the reasons I've already talked about. Today, the politics are much different, and it'd be hard to imagine a Republican president making that case that we need to cozy up to Arab states in lieu of cozying up to Israel. But at the time, this was a really hotly debated topic in the Republican Party.
What's going on in Israel and Palestine at this point that the United States is keeping an eye on?
Well, it's a time of turmoil. This is after World War II. There's a collapse of the imperial system. You mentioned the Balfour Declaration at the beginning. I mean, that came out of World War I and this era where still the British and French empires and then the declining Ottoman Empire controlled a lot of what we call now the Middle East. And that system maintains throughout the interwar period. So we have something called the Mandate System in the 1920s and 30s. This is when a lot of migration is happening by Jews to Palestine. And then the end of World War II really initiates the collapse of these imperial powers. So the British and French are still involved in the Middle East, but there are now a lot of independent countries like Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Egypt declare their independence during this period. And this is also the rise of Arab nationalism and communism as, particularly from the Americans' perspective, seen as anti-American or against American interest developments. And so all of this is happening around the mandate of Palestine, which turns into Israel, and then much of that mandate is actually controlled by Jordan after the war for independence. in 1948. And by the way, I just called it the War of Independence. This is the way the Israelis call it. Palestinians call it the Nakba, the disaster, because they see this as the, you know, sort of the original sin or one of the original sins of their loss of people of statehood and their status as largely refugees today. But that war is actually happening in 1948 to 1949. So the Declaration of Independence by the new Israeli state initiates a war where most of the Arab nations around Israel invade, and Israel is on its back feet for about a year, though they turn the tide pretty quickly. And this is one of these episodes in military history that a lot of people study. How did one little country, if you look on a map,
surrounded except by the Mediterranean.
That's right. That's right. If you look on a map, it's particularly pronounced, which is a very small plot of land and then a sea of Arab states around it. How did this little plot of land and the people on it defend themselves? Turns out the Arab armies were very disorganized, and there was a lot of infighting between those armies, and just a lot of things were happening. Also, many of those Arab states were not actually interested in creating a Palestinian state at that time. They were interested in trying to grab some territory for themselves. This is particularly Egypt and Israel. But in any case, Israel survives that war and is established. And there's massive population transfer during and after the war. So there are 700,000 Palestinians that flee their homes. And there's a lot of debate about exactly why they fled, and there's many, many reasons.
Flee their homes from Israel or
from what would
the
become,
greater area around Israel?
From what would become Israel, from the territory that at the end of the war Israel controlled. This creates a massive refugee population that ends up mostly in what we now call the West Bank, which was part of Jordan at that time, and in the Gaza Strip, which we're dealing with today as well. There's also another population transfer, which is after the war starts, it becomes very difficult to be a Jew in any of these Arab countries around the Middle East. And so there's actually about 500,000 Jews that flee the Arab nations and resettle in Israel. And this becomes a massive logistical project for this new state to absorb 500,000 new people, mostly poor, mostly non-Western in their culture and in their expectations.
And non-Jewish.
Well, they're Jewish. So these are the Jews fleeing the Arab states. And so they are Jewish, but they are not European Jewish. And so there is a cultural religious tie, but they're very different cultures. And most Israelis today who are Jewish come from that background, not from a European Jewish background. And this is a major demographic story in early Israel as well. And that means that many of the major issues that Israel is dealing with in the 1950s are issues around borders with these other Arab countries. There's armistices, but no peace treaties with any of these countries. And then other issues that, like water rights. There's not a lot of water in the Middle East. And with so many new immigrants, water, and particularly for farming, becomes really, really important. So maybe as hard as it is to imagine today, that was for many years, that was the top issue in the Middle East and in the Israel-Palestine region in particular was water rights.
Is it a matter of who controls the source of this water?
That's right. So you think of something like the Jordan River, mm-hmm. who gets to pull water from the river over time. And as new farming techniques are being developed, as development is happening all across the region after World War II, water becomes even more precious.
So at least originally, as all these nations' boundaries were being determined in this kind of turmoil after World War II in the Middle East, this wasn't really a nationalist war between Arab states and Jews. It was really a religious war. Religious cultural war?
It's a combination. It's really hard to disentangle these things. There's an inherent territorial nationalist component to it. There's a plot of land, two peoples who see each other as the rightful owners of that land, both can't control it at the same time. And so to the extent that that is a nationalist reason to sort of conduct a war, that is part of it. But there's a lot of the war and the conflict that does have religious resonances to it. So, for example, the city of Jerusalem is extremely important to both Jews and and Arabs, for Muslims and Christians. And so the status of Jerusalem becomes this intense issue that is actually, you know, there's fighting over it, but it's also a major diplomatic issue. Who gets to control Jerusalem? Who gets to control particularly the holy sites in the old city of Jerusalem, which include the Dome of the Rock, which is the third holiest site in Islam, and the Western Wall, which is the, you know, the barricading wall for the old temple for Jews in the Second Temple period. So so there's a religious component there as well. And then in an interesting other religious component is the way, if we go back to America, the way most Americans are reading this war has a strong religious filter to it as well. So particularly for Christians in the U.S., which is at this point a vast majority of Americans, it's hard to disentangle what's happening in the Middle East and either historical thinking about the Holy Land and the biblical lands, or for some Christians, future prophetic developments, and that what's happening in the Middle East has some type of significance in a sort of more cosmic grand
reading
way.
The Book of Revelations is this great dichotomy of struggle. It would be, as you say, Daniel, overwhelmingly Christian influence in this country or sympathy. Well, united with Jews too.
Yes.
Whereas Muslims in this country virtually unrepresented.
That's
so
right.
Would that tilt America at this point to be pro-Israel?
Yes. In cultural sympathies, in religious sympathies, there's a lot of seeming similarities between Israelis and Americans. And we see this, we just talked about religion. Another interesting way to think about this is in the 1950s, it's the era of the biblical epic movie.
That's true.
The Ten Commandments and so forth. And many of those, of course, those are about biblical stories, but they're always framed, as many movies are, in contemporary standards, whether you have Moses giving speeches that sound a lot like a Cold War speech about freedom, or you have representations of Jews and Christians representing Western civilization, and then Israel and the United States standing in for those two value systems. This is also the era when, in broader American culture, the idea of a Judeo-Christian tradition is at its peak in popularity. This is a term that sounds really, really old. Like, certainly people in the Middle Ages talking about Judeo-Christianity, they weren't. This was a concept that really emerged in a forceful way in the 1930s to try to frame what was different about the West from Nazi Germany and totalitarian systems like Soviet communism. And as we get into the Cold War period, this becomes heightened. And for many Americans, Judeo-Christianity and Americanism go hand in hand. And Israel and the U.S. then are the representatives of these two systems. So this is the cultural milieu that is making most Americans sympathetic to Israel. You can also think about the media environment was largely sympathetic to Israel as well.
And was that because there was a good deal of Jewish control of the media in this country, or is that an exaggeration?
I'd say that's an exaggeration, particularly to explain. I don't think that needs to even be part of the conversation to explain the strong pro-Israel sympathy in American media. You also have to remember, particularly when we get to the 50s, this is when the reality of the Holocaust is coming to bear for most Americans. Most Americans knew some details in the 1940s, but the real sort of blockbuster reporting and evidence gathering happened in the late 40s, early 50s, and took a while to get out to the public. And so, it was very hard to disentangle for Americans the Holocaust and the way that it destroyed an entire, you know, civilization of European Jewish Jewry, and Israel as the redoubt for the survivors of that disaster, that genocide. And this is a link that Israel encouraged as well. They wanted everyone to see them as the, you know, humanitarian stewards of the Holocaust survivors as well. But this was something that was quite pervasive in American culture and media reporting. And so when there was and there were many conflicts between Israel and its Arab neighbors, often one of the refrains was this going to be a second Holocaust? Would, if Israel didn't survive, what would happen to the Jewish occupants in Israel? And that raised the moral stakes of following Israel to a height that's almost hard to imagine how much higher it could go in that sense. And so in 1956, there's a war, and in 1967, there's another war. And both of these wars are framed in those ways as Israel is sort of the keeper of Jewish safety in the globe. And so Americans have a duty to support Israel for that reason.
We'll look further at that pivotal year of 1956 and U.S.-Israeli relations when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Daniel Hummel, and we're looking at a history, a 20th century history, not surprisingly, of U.S.-Israel relations beginning in 1948 and carrying through various crisis points in the years to follow. And one that stands out, as you've mentioned, Daniel, 1956, which becomes a matter of global concern. We hear about the Suez crisis and particular pressure points pinching off the supply from the Indian Ocean and even the Atlantic into the Mediterranean and that kind of thing. How does that develop?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, shipping issues are in the news again today with the Houthis and sort of attacking shipping right over in the ocean, right in the Middle East again. It's interesting to think about the Suez Crisis in 1956 because it brings together a few things we've talked about. This is a crisis that in part is due to Egypt, which at this point is run by an Arab nationalist named Nasser, Gamal Nasser, who nationalizes the shipping in Egypt. And this becomes a major concern because much of the shipping was controlled by Britain before that. And so this is the declining British influence in the Middle East. And so in a poorly planned sort of conspiracy, Britain, France, and Israel plot a way where Israel can invade Egypt and return control to Britain and France. And they execute this plan. Everyone sees through it pretty quickly. This happens right on the eve of the 1956 U.S. presidential election between
Eisenhower and Stevenson.
Between Eisenhower and Stevenson. Eisenhower is in office. He's not happy. This is very annoying to him. It's one of the few times after this crisis happens, it's one of the few times that the Soviet Union and the U.S. jointly condemn an act. The same time.
That would be unusual. But don't countries usually need some kind of rationale for that sort of world attention-grabbing maneuver?
Yes, there was a pretext, which was a raid that there had been regular raids by Egyptian sort of paramilitary groups into Israel between 1948 and 1956. So one of those was used as a pretext for this. But ultimately, it took just a few months and a very strong pressure from the international community, and particularly by the U.S., which Israel really depended on for economic aid at this time, to pull back out and return the situation to pre-1956 standards. So this is a crisis that really exposes the weakness of the European, particularly the European powers, Britain and France, and really also asserts U.S. influence in the region in a way that before the U.S. often deferred to Britain on a lot of the questions about Middle East-specific policy. As the U.S. is becoming even more aggressive, even more involved in the Cold War across the globe, it's seeing really important interests in the Middle East. And from 1956 on, basically, is the leading superpower trying to shape the region to its own interests.
Hard to imagine today how different the powers were in 1956 when you consider the largest U.S. air base outside of the U.S. was in Libya, and that a staunch ally of the country was Iran,
right,
with the Shah of Iran.
Yeah.
Very different power balance in 1956 from today. Different players, for sure.
That's right. And a lot of that, if you pull out your history textbook and you read about the Cold War, a lot of these alliances have to do with aligning for or against communism. One pattern is if the country has a monarch, they tend to be very anti-communist. If they have some type of nationalist leader, they tend to be much more what at the time was called the non-aligned movement, but much more open to working with either the Soviet Union or the U.S. And really playing those two sides off of each other for the best deal. So Nasser in Egypt was one of the leading non-aligned countries. So he took weapons support and financial support from both communist and capitalist countries. And so he was always a thorn in the side of someone like Eisenhower and later on Kennedy and others. Whereas Iran, which was run by the Shah until 1979, was adamantly anti-communist. They saw communists as the biggest threat to their regime, and so were eager to ally with the U.S. To fight communists.
And this whole question of human rights in a country like Iran, not on the table because priority was fighting communism?
Yes. At various points, it was thrown on the table, but it was never the primary reason why the U.S. did or did not support a country. And the U.S. would create different people within the government, would create different distinctions to try to justify this, you could say. And one of the key ones that emerged in the 1970s was the difference between a totalitarian and an authoritarian regime. And totalitarian being there's no hope. And that would be like the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And authoritarian regime being, well, we can work with the leader to try to change things. And that tended to be the more U.S.-friendly dictators.
Kind of a more benevolent dictator concept.
Yes. And to give credit to these thinkers and others, it's a very complicated world. And the idea that you would have, you know, sort of zero engagement with any regime that didn't have a Western-style human rights record would mean you'd basically not be dealing with most of the world. Now, that being said, a lot of the reasoning around this was very interest motivated. And so if there was a strong natural resource or a strong strategic reason why the U.S. needed to work with, say, Iran or Saudi Arabia, two countries in the Middle East that they worked with that had pretty horrible human rights records, they could find ways to justify that. And if you applied those same reasonings to other countries, there might be a reason why the U.S. didn't want to work with those countries. So it was very motivated, but there were recognitions, I should say, by the U.S. government that this wasn't always consistent thinking. And of course, the Shah in Iran had a pretty bad human rights record, and the regime that came after, the revolutionary regime, also had a horrible human rights record. And that became much more of an issue after the revolution, that the U.S., one of the reasons the U.S. opposed the Iranian Revolution was because of the horrible human rights record afterward.
U.S. and Britain in particular tapping oil in Arab countries, getting the concessions and that kind of thing?
Yes, this is happening. This is happening all the way back, even in the post-World War I days. And Iran's another key player in this period. Iran, though not an Arab country, was one of the major oil suppliers in the world at the time, and was a key asset for the British Empire. This was one of their major sources of oil. As we go into World War II and after, the oil supply in the global oil supply becomes much less focused on particular countries, and we have groups like OPEC emerge that create a different way that oil is traded in the globe. But it's all really dependent on stable oil mining in the Middle East to keep those supplies going. And so this is always a factor for Britain and the U.S. The difference would be Britain actually, you know, created an empire where they directly controlled these countries or these territories in some ways and actually drilled for oil in them. The U.S. was more interested in creating an economic system, a global system, where they had access to oil. And the U.S. was obviously much less interested in creating colonies in a place like Saudi Arabia, though you could argue that the military bases played a similar role in some ways. But the U.S. was much more interested in working through its allies and creating a stable situation where communism wasn't a threat and where the oil continued to flow without any break.
How did the situation in 1956 affect U.S. attempts to have this balanced relationship between U.S. and Israel and U.S. and Arab countries?
This was at the height of what I mentioned before, the even-handedness of the Eisenhower administration. And the overall calculus by the U.S. government was a sympathy for Israel and a recognition that in domestic political terms, there was sympathy for Israel among Americans, but also this more, you could say, hard calculating interest diplomacy that meant that the U.S. Diplomats in particular wanted to be as close to Arab states as they could be. And so, you know, there are key issues in the Arab-Israeli conflict, in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that the U.S. basically just wants to manage instead of solve. One of the key ones being the refugee issue. So we talked about hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were evicted or fled their homes after the 1948 war. This was a core issue, and it still is a core issue in the conflict, is what happens to those refugees. And the key claim by the Palestinians is that they get to return to their homes. Israelis are almost absolutely unified in being against this issue. Many of them live in the territory that these refugees would return to. And so the U.S. So this is the U.S. posture at a time like 1956 or frankly afterward. Solving this issue is very painful. In fact, there would have to be some type of imposed peace for this issue. The best interest of the U.S. is something that is more status quo. And so they want to somehow maintain the status quo, hold out hope that these issues can be solved in the future while maintaining good relations with all sides. And this is as a superpower, as a country that Israel has never been the top priority for any U.S. administration. It's always been important. It's never been the thing. This is how the U.S. has often approached the entire Middle East conflict, is as a managing strategy. And there have been peace processes, you know, galore, yes, and attempts by presidents to solve it. And many presidents have actually staked a lot of their personal social capital on solving it. But it's never been existential to U.S. Interests. It's never been as important as things that are directly involving the U.S. And that is one of the keys to understanding why the peace process has taken so long and hasn't actually come to a solution. It's because the U.S. has never been so invested in the core issues that it's been willing to actually stake its direct national interest on solving the issues.
As we get into the crisis in 1956 and the years following, and we have these Palestinians in Israeli-controlled territory, U.S. attitude toward Israeli treatment of Palestinians?
It's always a concern. We talked about human rights a bit. This is one of these issues that comes up. The number of Palestinians under Israeli occupation between 1956 and 1967 is less than it becomes today. So in 1967, Israel ends up taking a lot of territory that includes a lot of these refugee camps and Palestinian families that had fled in 1948. And at that point, and that's the situation we have today, there are literally millions of Palestinian Arabs who are under Israeli occupation, who have very limited civil rights, and who, you know, in all sense of the term, are under military occupation. The concern is even more then. In this earlier period, the U.S. is concerned about human rights for these Palestinian refugees. But this is another point where we got to pull out and see the context, you could even say the refugee context of the 1940s and 50s. The post-World War II moment, you could say the decade after that, has the most refugees in the history of humanity.
There's in Europe people, and throughout the
particularly
the world.
In Europe and in places like Turkey and Greece, which are not that far from Israel at the time. And so while they care about Palestinian refugees, the numbers are just such that there are just so many refugees to care about that the U.S. that never sort of is solely focused on Palestinian refugees. They're seen as part of this much bigger landscape of resettlement and eviction and ethnic cleansing and all the things that are going on in other parts of particularly Europe and you could say West Asia during this period that are fallouts from World War II. This is also a moment when the post-colonial movement is really taking...
accelerating, isn't
it? Yeah, really accelerating. And so there are countries all over the globe, Africa, Latin America, Asia, that are declaring independence and having refugee problems as well because of the nationalism and the way that minorities get singled out in these countries. At that point, Israel is just basically another case study in something that's happening all across the globe at this time.
Is there any kind of significant isolationism kind of reaction to World War II in this country, or does World War II serve as kind of an eye-opener that it's really a global situation that we're in now?
Yeah, there was a much stronger isolationist tradition, particularly in the Republican Party, in the 1930s and 1940s. You can think of Charles Lindbergh and the America
yes,
First movement in the
famously.
1930s.
Yeah.
Interesting enough, that quote I mentioned, that politics stops at water's edge, was uttered by Arthur Vandenberg, who was an isolationist Republican senator, who actually quoted that or said that to justify why he was becoming a Cold War hawk. He was abandoning his isolationism. This is 1947. And he was saying, you know, I was advocating isolationism all the way through the 30s and even before that. But because of the existential threat of communism, I'm now channeling Arthur Vandenberg. I am now going to support all of the measures that the Truman administration at that point is advocating. The Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, containment, these sort of key fixtures of the Cold War American foreign policy. That basically means the U.S. is now going to be interested in every part of the globe and is going to be concerned about any type of revolution or ideological movement because it's taking on this responsibility of representing the free world. So there is not a strong isolationist strand after 1948, after World War II. There is, however, a lingering – we've talked a bit about how much warm feeling there is by Americans toward Israel and toward the Jewish people after the Holocaust. There is still a strong, though diminishing, anti-Semitic tradition in the U.S. that sees – that will even invoke things like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a defunct, at that point, 60, 70-year-old document that was fake that claimed that Jews were, you know, sort of in a cabal running the world. There are still people in the 1940s and 50s who are invoking that type of anti-Semitism to say the support that the U.S. is giving Israel, even though it's nowhere near what the U.S. ends up giving Israel in later decades, is illegitimate because it is rooted in this power, this sort of Jewish anti-Semitic conspiracy. That's still something you can find, particularly in certain sectors of the right in the 1950s, that gets some play, but is sort of subsumed by these other factors that really mean most Americans in the 50s are not questioning strongly the Cold War policies of the U.S. This is that comes later with the Vietnam War and other things, but in the 50s, this is pretty much seen as a dire existential threat to U.S. interests.
We're going to look at a third pivotal year and maybe a couple of others after it too, but starting with 1967 and U.S.-Israel relations when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Daniel Hummel, and we're finding out about a history of U.S.-Israeli relations, and now we've come to another very pivotal year in those relations, the year 1967 and the beginning of the so-called Six-Day War, and we've already looked at the globe and said Israel is surrounded by unfriendly Arab states. And how did this war come about, and why only 6 days?
Yeah, it was a surprise to most people that it was so short. The 1967 war is in line with a lot of what we talked about. There's tensions between Israel and its Arab neighbors. And ultimately, in 1967, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan appear to be getting ready for war, to invade Israel, to try to, as the propaganda in those countries said at the time, to wipe Israel off the map. And Israel decides to preemptively launch a strike to try to fight the war on their terms. And they do so on June 5th of 1967. It is a stunning victory for Israel. They basically destroy the entire Egyptian Air Force before it has a chance to get off the tarmac. They best the Arab nations in every aspect of the war. And in some cases, it only lasts 6 days because they expand so quickly in 6 days that the other countries just beg for peace. And so Israel triples its size in 6 days. It ends up taking over the Sinai Peninsula, which is a very large, if you look on a map, it's quite large. They take over the West Bank, which was under Jordanian control. They take over the Gaza Strip, which was under Egyptian control. They take over the Golan Heights, which is up near Syria, and they take over all of Jerusalem, which is very symbolic and important. And this is when, in the pre-67 borders, the old city of Jerusalem, the historic city that would have been the city that King David would have maybe recognized some part of, though probably not, and Jesus and others, that was actually under control of Jordan up until 1967. So this is the first time that Israeli Jews get to go to the Western Wall, under Israeli control and pray. So this is very symbolic. So that all happens in 6 days, and that's, you know, we're still living in the reality of that war and its aftermath, in the sense that from that day on, all the sides end up gravitating toward a land for peace formula, for a peace agreement.
In other words, just let Israel have that real estate in exchange for ending the war.
It was let Israel will give up that real estate for peace with its neighbors. So Israel took the West Bank, Israel took Sinai. Ultimately, in 1979, in the Camp David Accords, Israel gives back Sinai for peace with Egypt. And this was so. This is the sort of deal as it's formulated in the UN and in the peace process is Israel got all this territory. If they can trade that territory for permanent peace with their neighbors, this is at least this is what is said by all parties that would be an agreeable deal to all sides.
That word permanent.
Yes,
is asking a lot.
It is, and this has been Israel's. This is another core issue. If the refugee issue is the core issue, maybe for Palestinians. And the right of return. One of the core issues for Israelis and Israel has been this idea of permanent security, or this idea is, can Israel ever live in a way where they aren't suspicious of their neighbors getting ready to attack them or undermine them? And this has been the golden chalice for Israeli diplomacy. And there was real hope in the aftermath of the 67 war that would be achievable. Through this land for peace, and there were people advocating that within the Israeli government. There were others saying that's a pipe dream, or there were others saying that's our rightful land. The West Bank in particular, that many on the right in Israel refer to it not as the West Bank but as Judea and Samaria, because those are its biblical terms. That's where Judea and Samaria were in Bible times. And so for some, and that includes many on the right wing of Israel, including Menachem Begin, a later prime minister, and Benjamin Netanyahu, who's still the prime minister today, that includes that area. And so that area is not to be traded for peace. That is to be permanent Israeli territory for time immemorial. And so that's another sort of thorn in the side of this land for peace idea, is that it's hatched by certain people. And the U.S. is very the U.S. is always about managing this situation and sort of trying to make it as irrelevant as possible to other things they want to do. So if Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon is getting the sense that a land for peace deal is something that everyone would be into, they would totally support that. But there are people on all sides who are also skeptical of this, or actually even don't want this deal, even as most of the peace process since then, and you can think of all of the 90s and the Oslo Accords, all that stuff is really premised on a land for peace bargain. There's always been constituents on all sides trying to undermine that agreement as well.
Has the U.S. been giving military aid to Israel?
Up until 1967, it was limited aid. That started in the 60s. Since then, it's been quite significant aid. And some of this has been actually as a result of some of these peace deals. So in 1979, as I mentioned, Egypt and Israel come to peace. Jimmy Carter brokers that. A cynical way to read that is basically the U.S. bribes both sides to come to peace. Both sides get amazing aid packages that include economic and military aid. And in 1994, Israel and Jordan come to peace, and there's a lot of aid attached to that as well. And then ever since 67 in particular, because Israel performed so well militarily, the U.S. has seen Israel as a military asset in the region. And Nixon saw Israel as a key part of his Nixon doctrine, as he called it. Later presidents saw Israel as really important to what they wanted to do in the Middle East. When we get to the War on Terror period, Israel is seen as a major counterterrorism ally. And in each case, part of the way that the U.S. expresses that need for Israel is through military intelligence and finance and economic aid. And, there's a bill that has been considered by Congress that would offer Israel $17 billion just right now because of the current war. And so that tradition continues even today.
And as you suggest, Daniel, sharing intelligence.
Yes, this has been a key part of what the U.S. has seen as Israel's value to U.S. Foreign policy and intelligence gathering, is that Israel, you might imagine from this story, it needs intelligence to survive. They've always felt that way, and have developed quite capable and wide-ranging intelligence networks. particularly in moments where the U.S. has not had the same level of intelligence expertise around the Middle East. They've relied on particularly Israel to help. There's also a lot of military technology sharing between the U.S. and Israel. Israel is one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world, and so they have a lot of military R&D that is also collaboration with the U.S. They also have just a big tech sector, and so a lot of the cybersecurity and other things that are a big part of what is now considered foreign policy or national security are also deeply tied into the Israeli intelligence community. So it's one of the ways where we don't often see that part of the relationship unless there's some story about a cyber attack or something. But Israel is likely, one of the U.S.'s top three intelligence allies. Maybe you could count Britain and maybe a couple other European countries in that. But Israel is absolutely central to how the U.S. conducts its intelligence across the globe.
Other inflection points leading up to the current situation in Israel that affect U.S.-Israel relations after 1973?
Yeah, so there's obviously the 73 war, which has its own logic to it that actually leads to the Camp David peace in the late 70s. One I might pick out is in 1987, there's the first Intifada. So this is in Arabic, it means the first uprising. And this is the civil, violent uprising of Palestinians who are under occupation against Israeli military occupation. And it's very the media changes. The way that the U.S. covers Israel changes a bit here, where there's a lot more emphasis on the civilian nature of Palestinians, who the iconic images are of Palestinian kids throwing rocks at Israeli tanks. And this might be this is a microcosm of how Israel's image has changed in U.S. media over time, though U.S. media can still be quite friendly to Israel. But up until 1967, Israel was seen as the underdog, as a humanitarian project, as the survivors of the Holocaust against all of these Arab
A
David against Goliath. And that has switched since 67. So since the massive acquiring of territory, and then Israel is clearly competent on the military front and is then occupying the civilian populations, that role has flipped a bit. And so now the Palestinians are David and Israel seems to be Goliath. And the first Intifada in the late 80s was really a moment where, in terms of perception, that flipped for a lot of Americans. It flipped for a lot of American Jews. American Jews after the 67 war were almost unified in their support of Israel, and they wanted to get active about it too. This is why one historian calls this the golden age of American Jewish support for Israel. That starts cracking in the 1980s. There's the Lebanon War in 1982, which Israel does not look good in that war. They commit some pretty atrocious civilian atrocities. And then the Intifada in 1987 really is a mixed message in terms of how should we understand Israel. And if we think about today, these questions of occupation remain center to how we think about Israel and what are the futures, what is the future of Israel. We think about this question of the West Bank, and what's different from 1987 to today is that there are now hundreds and hundreds of thousands of settlers in these areas that, in some world where there is a peace for a land for peace deal, would go to a Palestinian state. That seems really hard to imagine now, how we would even carve out a Palestinian state. And also the first Intifada is really when we get the main concerted peace process coming out of that. So the Intifada ends around 1990. There's a big conference in Madrid in 1991 that kicks off the Oslo process. And this is the process where Yasser Arafat, representing the PLO, and then various prime ministers in Israel really try to come to peace. And it sort of culminates in 2000 and a failed attempt to get to a peace deal. But that was for a whole generation, that was the hope, was that this process would lead to a permanent peace. And it failed, and we're still living in the aftermath of that failure.
Well, if we look at October 7th, 2023, is there a purpose behind that, or were the perpetrators just puppets of Hamas, which had a larger, more destructive global aim?
Yeah. I think it's still too early, certainly as a historian, it's still too early to draw too strong of conclusions on exactly what the motives were. However you go about trying to discern that question, it's important to always pull back and see what's happening with Hamas and Israel in a broader context. And so Hamas being closely tied to Iran means that there's a lot of motives that if you just looked at the people who run Hamas and Israel, you wouldn't necessarily detect, because there's a sort of whole other layer of national and regional interests at stake. And so I think the what happened on October 7th and the war since then fits into this story and has a lot of the same themes that we've been talking about. And there is a sense that one of the things Hamas was trying to avoid was Israel actually making peace with Saudi Arabia in a significant way, which would have been a massive sea change in this history that we've been talking about.
There had been some talk about that, hasn't there?
There had, and that's been one speculation, is that the timing of the October 7th attack was because that there was going to be an announcement pretty soon that Saudi Arabia and Israel were going to normalize relations. And that would have severely hurt the Palestinian cause for a state. If Saudi Arabia is no longer advocating for that state, they're by far the biggest Arab advocator still for a Palestinian state outside the Palestinians themselves. If Saudi Arabia normalized relations with Israel, which basically meant they wouldn't care as much about a Palestinian state, that would have been a major blow to the Palestinian nationalist cause. So that's been one speculation, is this attack and then the subsequent war has tabled those discussions ever since.
And Iran is an adversary of Saudi Arabia, so it would be to their advantage also to break up this pending alliance.
That's right. So there's multiple layers to how you think about this. Again, this is one explanation. I think there's probably, you know, at least half a dozen that have some, you know, validity to them. And it's also really early. You know, we're just a few months away from all this happening, and there will be more that will come out certainly in the next, you know, few years at least, that will help shed more light on that.
And in the meantime, U.S. Israeli relations get more complicated and turbulent and politicized too, I'm guessing, although it's kind of hard to say how that would play out.
Certainly, and just to return to one of our themes, that the politics doesn't stop at the edge of the water. You know, Biden as a Democrat has a really tough time threading this needle of his seeming desire, at least on an official level, to really be supportive of Israel. He made the historic decision to travel to Israel right after October 7th, a pretty
embracing Netanyahu.
Embracing him, basically saying there's no daylight between our countries on the need to, you know, basically destroy Hamas. And then the fallout from that in the Democratic Party since then, which has been increasing criticism of that closeness and particular concern by the Biden administration on particular groups of voters, including Muslim voters in a state like Michigan, which is a swing state. And is, you know, the disaster scenario for the Biden administration is that this is actually going to swing Michigan to the Republicans in the election. And so he's having to manage that whole domestic side. And of course, that's filtering into how he's dealing with Israel on a foreign policy side. And so if nothing else, this is a good, you know, case study of how the politics flows all the way through the water's edge. And what, you know, Biden has to decide and his people have to decide how much to weigh domestic versus foreign policy interests.
Daniel Hummel, thanks for giving us some perspective on the long history of U.S.-Israeli relations.
It's been a pleasure.
Our engineer is Tom Blaine. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air.